listening to Synesthesia, produced live in studio at Trent Radio 92.7 CFFF FM in beautiful Nungajawinong, Peterborough, Ontario, every Thursday at 5 p.m. It's also a podcast on Soundproof, creative nonfiction for audio. I'm your producer and host, L.A. Alfonso. In this audio program, film theory meets film music.
Hollywood Hotel. Good evening. Just a moment, I'll connect you.
Oh, for as long as I can remember, I watched the handing out of golden statuettes at the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences Awards. I never missed the Oscars. Until this year, because of my ongoing media blackout for self-care reasons, it shockingly completely missed my radar. I'd like to watch it eventually. I might be able to torrent a broadcast and I can fast forward through the interminable dance sequences. Yet my favorite moments are the supercuts to honor a certain persona or cinematic event or cinematic element. At that time, Chuck Workman's precious images set the precedent. The Academy gave him an Oscar and hired him on to produce more of the same for the award show. At my seminars, I showed Chuck Workman's precious images and had a discussion about where films are seen and how that might affect the way we watch them. I mentioned Babylon and my thesis that the engine of the movie theater is not the technology, but the crowd. The attraction, as per Eisenstein's measure, a unit of impression, is nothing without a spectator. The mere existence of the movie, if not its success, is dependent upon this symbiosis. What compels a moviegoer to stand up and cheer at the screen involuntarily? When I was a kid, my aunt and uncle took me to see Superman 2, and in one scene, Lois Lane fell off a helicopter dangling off the top of a tall building, but Superman managed to swoop down and take her in his arm. Yet at that moment, the previously dangling helicopter slipped off overhead and began to fall towards them. No problem. Christopher Reeves, who played Superman, seemed to say, and while carrying Margot Kidder, who played Lois Lane, with the other arm, caught the falling helicopter and flew up. At this moment, I remember very clearly my uncle, who sat beside me in the movie theater, stood up and applauded, as did many others in the darkened room. It was his involuntary jump for joy that stuck with me. It was not unlike being a spectator at a sports game. The spontaneous bodily reaction that erupts from watching a movie is part of cinema's power that intrigued me ever since that moment.
To be an actor, see Mr. Factor, you make your kisser look good.
Go out and try your luck, you may be Donald Duck. Hooray for Hollywood!
They hire fellas whose physiques are good, and then they tell them they're the perfect shape men to act. act like ape men, and they convince, and they should. They make them grunt and yell, oh, 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 oh.
And people think they're swell, oh, 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 oh. Hooray for Hollywood,
it's really got me, hooray.
Cohen's paper on 12 Monkeys, he says it belongs to the tradition of the film homage. And director Terry Gilliam thought deeply about the photographs, the shots, and the sounds of La Jetée. He lives it, this film, or dreams living there. The author continues to say that to pay filmic homage, it goes beyond the act of admiration or emulation towards an act of a rivalry or competition with the predecessor. The homage can just as easily be cannibalized by the specular film that it emulates. The homage expresses a kind of love for the original material. I'm interested in why we love movies. I'm fascinated by Chuck Workman's title, Precious Images, for his 8-minute crosscut of over 100 years of American filmmaking. The description of the film on Letterboxd says, the incredible shortcuts of roughly a second each push the audience into a kind of trance that takes them on a journey into their individual memories of great films of the 20th century. My emphasis on the audience's individual memories points to a key idea. Our embodied experiences of film, through our eyes, our senses, then, finally, through our memories and subconscious, define cinema as palpable and can trigger chemical reactions in the body, can make the knee jerk, and it's capable of catalyzing a process that changes the viewer forever. We can think fondly of films. We can have comfort movies. In a similar way, we have comfort foods. Is this partly how a film becomes a cult movie? For me, the chemical trace of La Jetée goes back to the early 90s, to the time I was in film school in Toronto. Not only did we see it for class, but the year I entered York University, they were getting rid of all the old 16mm film reels, and some of my film school classmates got a hold of a print of Marker's La Jetée and had frequent screenings at Winters, our dormitory residence, with a rattling borrowed projector. I have to talk to Steve Milne or Mike Holland about this to piece this together accurately. What I remember distinctly was everyone's glee at the find. Finding a print of Chris Marker's film is 10 times like finding rare vinyl at a yard sale. In the age of mechanical reproducibility, the number of people who get to experience the aura of the, quote, original depends on how many copies were made. I remember reading or watching a documentary about the cult of Vertigo, 1958. From what I recall, filmmakers of the 70s Hollywood frequently had private screenings in their home theaters of Alfred Hitchcock's masterpiece. How do we account for the fact that La Jetée is a cult film while 12 Monkeys is not? Asks Cohen in his paper. He says the distinction between fads and fashions as epidemics. After the work of Jean Baudrillard and Dan Sperber, who considers myths to be like chains of information prone to genetic engineering, similar to models of viral transmission and contagion, it leads us to consider a system which collects the work of myth in the history of cinema according to an epidemiological model. In other words, 12 Monkeys didn't simply catch if, as Cohen says, cinema corresponds to the great mythographic adventure of our time, the power of invention and the persistence of certain films in our culture points towards the new virtual diffusion of the mythical in the postmodern era. It's my first encounter with Bazin's book, What is Cinema? I think I would like to read the whole thing. On page 168, I came across a passage that seems to explain my question about what makes cinematic images, like in Workman's Precious Images, precious exactly. Bazin writes, "Thanks to the cinema and to the psychological properties of the screen, what is symbolic and abstract takes on the solid reality of a piece of ore. The key that makes this precious ore, he points out, are the psychological properties of the screen. We have an emotional attachment to cinematic images, perhaps because the original narratives from which they spring leave a hormonal trace. The story from which the image belonged created a chemical reaction in the brain that gets re-triggered upon seeing it again. In 12 Monkeys, the protagonist, James Cole, is sitting in a movie theater playing Hitchcock's Vertigo, and he says, I think I've seen this movie before, when I was a kid. Simultaneously on screen, the action in Vertigo shows James Stewart asking Kim Novak, have you been here before? Cole, seated in the theater, is mesmerized by the movie and gets at a striking comparison. As writer Ben Yagoda puts it, watching a film at different times in your life might be similar to keeping on going back in time to the same moment. Cole says, it's just like what's happening with us. The movie never changes. It can't change, but every time you see it, it seems different because you're different. The crosshairs at the very start of trying to be some kind of hero suggests the camera as a weapon. The weapon in this case is the camera to help with the hero's mission to document the world. Trying my best to save these things from extinction, like I said. A hero, in my estimation, is one who saves lives. And in a sense, I believe that cinema had that power. The camera can capture a glance of the fleeting comet streak that is a human being. the image is precious because of our emotional attachment to the life, the person, place, or thing that once was and forever frozen in frame on screen. I wish I could remember the name of the book in which there was the concept of a flashlight that, when directed at a specific location, the user gets to see a kind of hologram of what took place there in the past. For the camera's viewfinder to act like a temporal telescope in MeMovie, we'd have to go on location. So the process of determining where to go would have to start by looking at archival footage. Dreams come true is a recurring theme in Academy Awards acceptance speeches. Last night's live broadcast of the Oscars saw Ki Hui Kwan win a golden statuette. Kwan played Short Round in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom and Data in The Goonies. In a mediascape with little Asian representation of boys my age at the time, I was curious about him. But I also could not altogether relate. He kind of looked like me, but not really.
My journey started on a boat. I spent a year in a refugee camp. And somehow, I ended up here on Hollywood's biggest stage. They say stories like this only happen in the movies. I cannot believe it's happening to me. This is the American dream.
What I noticed was something subtler. I saw how he developed a kind of humorous persona in order to adapt to his world, and I could relate to that. In order to compete with systemic, institutionalized, and unconscious racism, I became a high achiever and an entertainer. And these personalities came with a lot of unhealthy perfectionism. And as it turns out, I've only just become self-aware about certain aspects of my person. I can write about it with certainty only after many years of therapy and self-help books. For Kwan's talents to be recognized and for him to say dreams come true means a little bit more to me than the others who said the same words last night. My journey started on a boat, he said. I spent a year in a refugee camp and somehow I ended up here on Hollywood's biggest stage. He continued, they say stories like this only happen in the movies. I cannot believe it's happening to me. This is the American dream. And then later he said, dreams are something you have to believe in, and I almost gave up on mine. To all of you out there, he said, pointing at the camera, directly at the viewer, please keep your dreams alive. It was as if he was talking directly to me. I saw last night's broadcast as if Data from the Goonies is straight talking to me. I caught myself a few times inwardly cringing whenever an award recipient thanked their mom. An emotional Kwan began his acceptance speech with, "My mom is 84 years old and she's at home watching. Mom." He looked straight at the camera lens, held up his award, and shakily said, "I just won an Oscar." Last year, with the complete trust of a child, I really believed that one day in December, my film would win me an Oscar at last night's ceremony. In an alternate universe, I partied last night to celebrate, getting the rejection emails last summer from the 3 Oscar-qualifying film festivals that I submitted to were big blows in a season already filled with big losses. I can think back to my complete and utter disbelief that the winds were finally in my favor. My time had come. With each rejection letter, I got the feeling the chances of ever achieving my dream goals got slimmer and slimmer. The image I had of giving my acceptance speech got dimmer. I recall now that I was planning on thanking my mom, and thanking and saying that I wish my dad had lived long enough to see this beautiful moment. He believed in me until the end. I try to recall the feeling now that I had imagining myself giving that speech. I imagined that Rob Fortin and Sue Newman would be up there on Hollywood's biggest stage with me. Sue would pat me on the back on live television, like she did throughout the production. I would cry. However, while watching it last night, I noticed that my feelings had drastically changed. My recent disconnection with my family makes me feel uninspired to achieve fame and glory. Right now, I feel more inspired to live a quiet life, away from the pressures of such a business. I can see myself teaching in a small seaside beach town and be perfectly happy. In his acceptance speech, Kwan noted, "I owe everything to the love of my life, my wife Echo, who month after month, year after year, for 20 years, told me that one day my time will come." He said, "Dreams are something you have to believe in." He had help, I tell myself. He had it easy. Who will help me? Who will help me believe in my dreams now? Yet I have a feeling that if I don't believe in my own dreams, I'd be hard-pressed to find anyone to support me in the first place. You're listening to Synesthesia, produced live in the studio at Trent Radio 92.7 CFFF FM in beautiful Nungajewanong, Peterborough, Ontario, every Thursday at 5 p.m. And it's also a podcast on Soundproof, creative nonfiction for audio. I'm your producer and host, L.A. Alfonso, in this audio program, Film Theory Meets film music. I'll be linking all of my stuff that you could hear on the show notes and the podcast. And now I feel like I'm going to play you a track from One Day in December. It is, in fact, a musical with lyrics by Rob Fortin and music by Susan Newman, and sung by Marcy Lukianchuk and a host of children. And there's a scene. I'll play you this clip. It's a clip that shows the children giving a presentation, a children's alphabet during wartime, and it quickly gets interrupted by an explosion and segues into a song called "Is This the War?" from One Day in December.
A is for armistice, which we pray for every day.
B is for the battlefields from Ypres to Cambrai.
C, of course, is Christmas, the precious baby's birth.
D is for the dangers that surround our war-torn earth.
E stands for the enemy. Will we someday call them friend?
F's the fields of France, which we are sworn to defend.
G and G is good King George, for whom our school is named.
H, the heroes of the war, the injured and the maimed.
I is for the infantry. God protect our fighting men.
J is for the justice he confers on us and them.
K is for Lord Kitchener, the hero of Khartoum.
Lusitania is L, which met a watery doom.
M stands for mustard gas. We will use it if we must.
N is for all nature, all things return to dust.
O is for the oceans that the British rule over.
P is for the peacetime that will see us live in clover.
Q is for the Quaker that feeds our hungry fighters.
Come to our town. Oh, the fields.
Yeah, I've never seen myself as a Filipino reflected in the Hollywood screen until Easter Sunday, like 2022, directed by J. Chandrasekhar and starring comedian Joe Coy, with a plot that revolves around a single father who attends a gathering of his loud and dysfunctional Filipino-American family on Easter Sunday. And yet the film only served as an inspiration for me to do my own version. The closest I would come to Hollywood representation while growing up was Lou Diamond Phillips in La Bamba, 1987. I didn't know then that Phillips is Filipino. He played a Chicano-American in the Richie Valens biopic, and yet he became my closest celebrity lookalike for a little while. After reading a chapter in Black Spectatorship, Problems of Identification and Resistance by Manthia Diawara, it triggered a bunch of different feelings that I had not anticipated. It pointed me to times when I did not enjoy looking at the screen, and I became what Diawara calls a resistant spectator. Since the mid-70s, much has been written on the subject of spectatorship. Early landmarks in the debate, such as articles by Christian Metz on the imaginary signifier, or Laura Mulvey's on visual pleasure and narrative cinema, and Stephen Heath's on difference, with their recourse to Freud and Lacan, tended to concentrate the argument around gendered spectatorship. More recently, debates have begun to focus on issues of sexuality as well as gender, yet with one or two exceptions, the prevailing approach has remained colorblind. Diawara questions aspects of the prevailing theories around spectatorship. He wants to examine instances of film consumption from the position of a Black male spectator. He wants to suggest that the components of difference among elements of a race, gender, and sexuality give rise to different readings of the same material. Diawara makes me aware of my own subjective reading of any film from a brown male perspective, which makes me sympathetic across many different races, yet a specifically Filipino corollary is rare. Diawara argues that the dominant cinema situates Black characters primarily for the pleasure of white spectators, male or female. To illustrate this point, one may note how Black male characters in contemporary Hollywood films are made less threatening to whites either by white domestication of Black customs and culture, a process of deracination and isolation, or by stories in which Blacks are depicted playing by the rules of white society and losing. The usual Hollywood take on Filipinos was appended recently in Triangle of Sadness, 2022, directed by Ruben Östlund, yet it veered into a kind of fantasy through hyperbole. It played to my sympathies. I was thoroughly invested in the Filipina housekeeper character and her character's claim to power scratched a cinematic itch that I had not known was previously there. I realize now, after thinking about it, that I had always avoided certain movies because I felt truly uncomfortable with Asian representations, especially by white actors in brownface, like Mickey Rooney in Breakfast at Tiffany's, 1961, or Marlon Brando in Tea House of the August Moon, 1956, Long Luck Dong, the racist Asian caricature in 16 Candles, 1994, only aggravated racism amongst all of us with even the tiniest resemblance to him. 22 years later, Edge of 17 twisted the stereotype by making a Korean boy a full-blown love interest for a teenaged white girl. Yet it still had deeply embedded tropes to let go of. Filipino-American actor Paolo Montalban played Prince Charming in a 1997 racially revisionist version of Cinderella, reinvented to be black. Casting Montalban may have made sense to a white casting director, but I think funding would never be raised for a brown Prince Charming in a typical white production. In the 1961 version of West Side Story, the actors playing Puerto Ricans were mostly white, wearing makeup and chattering in fake accents. The only Puerto Rican was star Rita Moreno, who was forced to wear brown face right along with them. Steven Spielberg set out to fix those flaws with his 2021 remake, but ultimately the Latinx community said it was not enough and voted thumbs down even with the new version. A friend recommended that I watch Netflix's Nurse Ratched for a particularly strong Filipino character played by actor John Briones. Yet, I found the character lacking in so many ways and another victim of hyperbole. Diawara writes, one of the roles of black independent cinema, therefore, must be increased spectator awareness of the impossibility of uncritical acceptance of Hollywood products.
So many roles for you to play just to stay in the game. Will you follow the lead or dance to a tune with a different beat? Mother, father, daughter or son, they're all one and the same. Then you discover you've played them so long you don't know your name. After learning a predetermined roles they've set for you, now's the time to realize you can do what you wanna do. Since you were born, you played it straight, never swayed from the norm. Now that you're grown, you're searching for goals you can call your own. Where will you turn? You're puzzled and troubled by what you've learned. You could run somewhere, but will you find peace of mind awaiting there? After learning a predetermined roles they set for you, now's the time to realize you can do what you wanna do. You can do what you wanna do. You can do what you wanna do, yeah. And do what you wanna do. You can be who you wanna be. You can love who you wanna love. You can do what you wanna do. You can do what you
brother to brother. Black men loving black men, a call to action, a call to action, an acknowledgement of responsibility.
We take care of our own kind when the nights grow cold and silent. These days, the nights are cold-blooded, and the silence echoes with complicity.
In 1978, Universal Pictures screens a Vietnam War drama called The Deer Hunter for a test audience in Detroit, Michigan. Despite starring a Robert De Niro hot off the tail of the recent success of Taxi Driver and The Godfather Part II, John Cazale and Meryl Streep, the test screening bombed. Universal Pictures executive Tom Mount called it the worst screening he'd ever seen. Fearing they had a flop on their hands and unsure of how to proceed, Universal execs turned to Alan Carr, writer and producer who had recently seen massive success with Grease and who was gaining a reputation for his marketing strategy. As Robert Hoffler tells the story in his book Party Animals, Carr knew just the way to market what he called a long movie about poor people who go to war and get killed.
Michael Cimino for The Deer Hunter.
The key was going to be leveraging the power of the Academy Award nominations. Oscar bait had already been a term for several decades at this point, referring to movies that were obviously trying to get Oscar nominations. But Carr's innovation was this: screen the film in limited release for just 2 weeks at the end of the year, the minimum the movie needed to qualify for the Academy Awards. Then once the nominations were announced, expand the film into wide release, using the nominations to drive up box office sales. The scheme worked. Deer Hunter won 5 Oscars, including Best Picture, and ultimately made almost $50 million in the box office off of its $15 million budget. And Oscar baiting as a deliberate marketing strategy was born. And it's a strategy that's still going strong to this day. If you've ever wondered why there's so many movies that get packed into the last few weeks of December, this is a big reason why. The Oscars, the oldest worldwide entertainment award show, are an annual source of excitement and frustration among many movie fans and filmmakers alike. At this point, the online film discourse decrying the Oscars' sins and missteps is almost as much of a cinephile tradition as the award ceremony itself. One of my old videos that participates in this trend was a big part of my early YouTube success. And we all know the frustration of a movie we love being snubbed or the surprise of an unexpected win, good or bad. But behind these choices, both the ones that frustrate us, the ones that confuse us, and the ones that feel deserved, lies an invitation-only club with a membership list that's kept a secret, and many other interconnected forces trying to exert their influence on the outcome of the awards. While a lot of time is spent discussing the outcome of the machinery of the Academy Awards, not a lot of time is spent analyzing the machinery of the awards themselves. But whether you're an engrossed film fan closely following the awards season, or someone who just thinks that the Oscars are a good old boys club of vain celebrities handing out golden statues to each other, I think you do have to acknowledge that the Academy Awards have an impact on the industry. Many filmmakers do strive to get recognized at the Oscars, and so what gets recognized there has an impact on the kinds of movies we get to see. And because what gets nominated and what wins ends up influencing box office receipts, the kinds of things that win and get nominated have a big influence on the kinds of things that can get funding in Hollywood, which in turn affects what we get to watch. So I wanted to dig in to try to understand why they are the way they are. What are the forces behind the scenes that influence the snubs, nominations, and wins? The Oscars have a pretty bad track record for giving the awards to the movies that will continue to resonate with the hearts and minds of audiences for decades afterwards. Filmmakers who are now considered legendary greats like Stanley Kubrick and Alfred Hitchcock never got Best Director awards. Similarly, some of the movies that are now considered the greatest of all time, like Citizen Kane, Vertigo, and Goodfellas, were overlooked by the Academy in favor of what a lot of people would argue are lesser films. Some of the best actors and filmmakers working today have never won any awards, and significant quality work from women, people of color, and other marginalized groups is consistently overlooked. Obviously, we can't expect an award ceremony to be perfect and prescient. You know, it's much easier to pick out the great films in hindsight. But sometimes these oversights seem obvious even as they're happening, and we're hoping here to gain some understanding into why these missteps happen. It's the job of the Academy members to choose the nominees and the winners, so it makes sense to start our analysis by understanding who those people are.
Yeah, that was Thomas Flight on the Oscars. I will link that video in the show notes if you're interested. He provides a great breakdown of how the Academy Awards actually work. How many voters there are and how many films that they get to vote on and how many films the voters actually get to see out of the 300 or so that gets shortlisted. And before that, we heard the end credit music from Marlon Riggs' Tongues Untied from 1989, a documentary about the experiences of black homosexual men living in America, an example of cinema of the real, a reaction to the lack of black representation in cinema. There's so many different examples of problematic representations from Disney's Peter Pan to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Scarface, Dusk Till Dawn, even Lawrence of Arabia, Rules of Engagement, Aladdin, you know, from a recent lecture by Dr. Mark Allwood, we were talking about Robert Stamm and Louise Spence's colonialism, racism, and representation, and how cameras sort of carry a certain bourgeois consumerist humanism, and when deployed for television and cinema, they change the subject position of the operator into the position of master of the audiovisual. It's sort of a new kind of visual conquistador. It produces us as subjects, transforming us into armchair conquistadores, affirming our sense of power while making the inhabitants of the third world objects of spectacle for the first world's voyeuristic gaze. So the birth of cinema corresponds with the height of colonialism in the early 1900s. It is thus no surprise that cinema worked in favor of the colonizer. You're listening to the work of Daniela Pinto, John Muir at Trout Hollow. That's the film, that's what the film is called. And The Whisper of Succulents. And the work of Brian Eno from Film Music Collections, 1976 to 2020. You're listening to Synesthesia, produced live in the studio at Trent Radio 92.7 CFFF FM in beautiful Nagajiwanang, Peterborough, Ontario, every Thursday at 5 p.m. And it's also a podcast on Soundproof, creative nonfiction for audio. I'm a producer and host, L.A. Alfonso. In this audio program, film theory meets film music. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back next week.